Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, or MCAD, handles complaints from people who feel they've been discriminated against at work. Maybe they were fired, didn't get a promotion, for example. It turns out MCAD is taking a really, really long time to handle those complaints, as in 7, 10, even 17 years to issue rulings. That is according to new reporting by WBUR's Simone Rios. Now, that can have a tremendous impact on a life, and it can also create disincentives for a worker to file a complaint, or maybe even impunity in bad acting employers who know nothing may happen, or at least not happen for a really long time. Tom Murphy is a lawyer with the Disability Law Center. He has been through these delays with clients who filed complaints with MCAD and joins us now. Tom, thanks.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So, Tom, maybe give us an example of a complaint that you have filed for one of your clients. What was the complaint?
Well, I currently represent clients who have complaints related to discrimination based on their disability. And unfortunately, many of those cases involve someone who has been terminated, allegedly because of a disability-related reason. And so I've had cases recently that we filed at the commission that have taken 2 years or more to get to a finding of probable cause, which is the end of the investigative stage.
So that's just one stage?
That's just the first stage in the process. The MCAD does offer voluntary mediation after a complaint is filed, but it is voluntary. So someone who goes through the investigative stage has their case looked at by an investigator who gathers the facts from both sides involved and makes a determination of whether or not there's probable cause.
So, Tom, what should be a reasonable expectation for, let's say, the first phase? What would be reasonable to expect? Because I imagine an investigation does take a while, but 2 years for one phase does feel like a long time.
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at the MCAD's own regulations, they aspire to an 18-month investigation. Now, keep in mind that deadline is often not met. But even a year and a half seems like an awfully long time just to wait to find out if there's enough evidence to go forward. And, you know, justice delayed really is justice denied. I mean, there is certainly truth to that phrase. And some people don't bother to stick with it until the end of even that initial process. Because most of the people there, the fact of the matter is, don't have lawyers representing them. And they have so many other things going on in their lives that to wait two or more years just for someone to say, yeah, there's enough evidence here to go forward to the next stage is really, I think, too long.
So let's say one of your clients gets through that first stage. All in, on average, how long does it take to close one of these for you, in your experience?
Well, so you're talking about after the probable cause finding, the MCAD then has a mandatory conciliation session, a mediation between the parties, and they do a great job with that. And honestly, most of the cases or many of the cases that get to that stage do settle because, frankly, you know, there is motivation on both sides to settle these cases.
And how long does that part take?
Well, after a probable cause finding, that is usually scheduled within a couple of months for that to happen, and then that's usually just one session, and the case either settles or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then it moves on to the next stage, which is discovery between the parties, and then public hearing after that.
So all in total, Tom, what is the longest it's taken for one of your cases to come to complete closure?
I would say probably about 7 years because you have a public hearing And then you have to wait for a decision. It's not like when you're in court and you're trying a case to a jury where you get the decision, you know, within a day or two. After you've presented your case to one of the hearing officers, you wait again for the decision to be issued. And unfortunately, that wait alone can be upwards of a year. And then there's an appeal process within the commission. It's known as an appeal to the full commission after the hearing officer renders that that public hearing decision. And that process can take anywhere from another 6 months to a year or so.
What do your clients tell you in terms of the toll this takes on them? How does this, I mean, I can imagine there's just an incredible emotional strain, but what do you hear from your clients?
Well, for my clients who stick around for the entire process, it's like an albatross. I mean, it's hanging over their heads. I mean, these are cases that involve very emotional issues. Losing a job is one of the most stressful things that a person can experience in their lives. And to then have to go through a process where you're reliving that experience, because that's really what happens, is that every 6 months or every year or so, when there is an event, the individual is reliving the experience that happened to them. And so it's just, it's very hard. It's hard to get closure. And in my experience, a lot of my clients have really, really almost above anything else have wanted closure. They've wanted someone to look at the facts and say, yes, you were discriminated against. And to wait 6 or 7 years for that type of closure is very difficult for someone to go through. And unfortunately, a lot of people do give up, again, especially people that don't have the resources to have a lawyer.
That is Tom Murphy. He is a lawyer with the Disability Law Center, and he represents clients who are filing complaints with the MCAD. Tom, thanks.
Thank you.
So reporter Simone Rios is here with us now in our latest edition of From the Newsroom. Simone reported on this story here at WBUR. Welcome back, Simone.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first, I know you spoke with Tom when you were doing the reporting, which is now available at the website, WBUR.org. What reactions to what you just heard from him?
Yeah, I mean, first, I want to thank Tom Murphy for even speaking to us. He was one of the only lawyers who would talk to us, because as you can probably imagine, not every lawyer wants to publicly criticize an agency where they have business. But Tom Murphy used a phrase, justice delayed is justice denied. And I heard that throughout our reporting on this. And if that's true, then what's the state of justice in the Discrimination Commission and elsewhere in Massachusetts? Tom also pointed out that people at the MCAD often don't have lawyers representing them. And this is a key role of the MCAD, the fact that people who can't afford a lawyer can still seek justice. But that means these delays could be impacting the poor more than anybody else.
Because if you could afford a lawyer, you could go through standard civil court.
Exactly.
So, Simone, how and when did you first find out about these kinds of delays?
Yeah, we were able to find documentation going back really to the 1970s that these kind of backlogs existed. The agency, the MCAD, has long been known for tardiness. But what we didn't know is that nowadays it can take 10, 15, even 17 years or longer to get a final resolution on a case. In fact, Tiziana, we heard from a listener today who said their case actually took 27 years to reach completion. So, you know, nearly three decades. How can you expect people to come forward with those kind of stories?
So what had you expected and what surprised you about this?
One of the things I was most blown away by was how much work these people at the Commission Against Discrimination have to deal with. So when the process starts, there's this investigation that takes an average of 2 years. But each one of those investigators has 200 or even more cases on their desk. So it's hard to imagine for me as a reporter having to juggle 200 stories, never mind 200 legal disputes. We reached out to a few neighboring states to see what their caseload was like. Connecticut got back to us saying that each investigator had roughly 30 cases assigned. So our investigators in Massachusetts have five, six, 7 times the caseload of their counterparts in Connecticut.
Why, Simone?
You know, there are many reasons for this, but from our reporting, I think it comes down to 2 major categories. On the one hand, the MCAD will tell you it's severely understaffed. So, for example, 25% of the investigative positions right now are vacant, and all 3 of the commission's hearings officers retired during the pandemic. But on the other hand, some people say there's a number of things the MCAD could do to make cases go more smoothly, like curtailing the kind of litigation that causes cases to drag on. We spoke to a former member of the MCAD's investigations unit who said the agency needs to pay its investigators more if they expect to keep them. Tom Murphy, who you spoke to before, thinks more should be done to promote mediation. But, you know, if you ask 10 of the stakeholders, you'll get 10 different answers, and they should all be considered.
So bring it home for us, Simone. Tell us about one of the people that you talked to in your reporting who went through this.
So the first one is Michelle Pavlov. She lives in Barnstable on the Cape. She brought a case 7 years ago after she said she was fired for being pregnant from a flooring company down there. She had nothing but good things to say about the MCAD, the people who work there. But, you know, you can only imagine what it's like having something like this hanging over your head for so long. Let's listen to what she has to say.
Originally, as I understand it, they were saying that it could take a few years for it to come to fruition. I wasn't aware that a few meant 7. And they said that if they do appeal, that could take even longer.
And, you know, the appeal just began a couple months ago, and she has no idea, but it could take another 2, 3, 4, 5 more years. Nobody knows.
Now, the company that she's accusing, did they talk to you, and was the MCAD cooperative with you?
Yeah, the MCAD was very transparent, very communicative. We had a constant flow of questions for them, and they always got back to us quickly. As for the employer who Pavlov is going after, they didn't get back to us, but we were able to locate the recording from the Zoom hearing that took place last year and got a sense of their defense. So they said they fired Pavlov because she was underperforming, and they made the claim that because they didn't have 6 full-time employees, that they were exempt from the discrimination statutes. In both cases, the MCAD disagreed and ordered them to pay Pavlov $70,000. Because they're appealing, however, Pavlov worries after another several years go by that she won't be able to collect.
Any thread on this that you want to follow going forward, Simone?
You know, we've been looking more broadly at discrimination and the systems in place in Massachusetts to prevent discrimination in realms like housing, employment, a number of areas, property records. And it's something that we plan to keep an eye on in the months ahead. So whether realtors, for example, found to discriminate ever face consequences, and more broadly, whether the level of discrimination that occurs, why it doesn't seem to change over time, despite all these mechanisms in place to prevent it. But we'll have more on that for you next time, Tiziana.
Yeah, and you'll come back and share it with us?
Of course.
Excellent. WBUR reporter Simone Rios from the newsroom. Simone, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, did you like this installment of From the Newsroom? Let us know what you thought, and you can do that by texting the word BOSTON to 617-766-0382 to join our text club. That's the word BOSTON to 617-766-0382. Unemployment has been top of mind since the start of the pandemic. In the early months, claims in Massachusetts were topping more than 600,000 a week. They eventually overwhelmed State Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, and the Commonwealth turned to federal loans to keep benefits flowing. And that was just the latest financial shock to a fund that's been chronically shortchanged for years. So the state put together a commission to make recommendations on how to fix some of these systemic funding issues, And they gridlocked. No agreement, even on recommendations after 11 meetings. Well, joining us now here in the studio, Evan Horowitz. He is executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University, also a member of that Unemployment Insurance Commission. Welcome, Evan.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's great to have my first morning session with you here.
It's great to have you here. Were you shocked that you guys couldn't come to agreement on recommendations?
I mean, shocked is very strong. It's hard in these circumstances. I was definitely disappointed. The unemployment insurance system in the state needs to be reformed. This was a great opportunity to do it, and we didn't.
All right, so let's backtrack for a second. In two sentences, how does the current system work? What is the unemployment insurance?
There's a really high bar.
I know you can do it.
How does the system work? Well, you lose your job through no fault of your own. You apply to the state, and you're eligible to receive benefits from the state amounting to about half of your lost earnings. Where does that money come from? It comes from a tax on businesses. They pay in, and then when you lose your job through no fault of your own, you can claim a share of those benefits. I guess that's the short version of it. I'm going to add more sentences. One thing you could imagine that would be a problem here is that, you know, when the economy sours and we enter a recession, lots and lots of people lose their jobs. So suddenly the state has to pay all these people unemployment insurance benefits all at once. And this would be a terrible time to go to businesses and say, hey, we need you to pay more in taxes because we have all these unemployment insurance claims. The businesses would say, what are you talking about? We can't sell more stuff. The economy's tanking. So the way we get around this is that the system is forward funded. When times are good, we ask businesses to pay into the system. When times are bad, we pay more out to workers. And this is, I think, the best way, the right way to do it. And if you do it in a sound way, you can keep your system kind of solvent so that you have enough money when things go bad. And we haven't done that. We haven't done that for a really long time.
Meaning we haven't put the money in the good times.
Exactly.
Why?
Exactly. There are two reasons. There's a technical reason, there's a political reason. And I'll start with the political reason because I think it's kind of more interesting. But basically, we have a system where when we don't have enough money in this trust fund, basically a savings account, we don't have enough money in the unemployment insurance savings account, tax rates are supposed to automatically increase on businesses. So that's a nice check, right? Things are bad. Well, automatic. Except every year, the legislature steps in and says, yeah, we're supposed to automatically increase tax rates on businesses, but let's not do it this year. Now's not a good time. And they did this every year since the Great Recession. Like, there were 10 years.
So, like a decade.
Yeah. There were 10 years, at least, where tax rates were supposed to go up because we were not putting aside enough money. And the legislature stepped in under pressure from business groups and said, nah, not now. Let's wait a little while. And to be clear, there are times when that's appropriate. There are times when you say, actually, businesses aren't doing well. We shouldn't raise unemployment tax rates right now. But there are times when we should do that and we need to do that. So this is the political problem. And then there's a technical problem. The technical problem is that benefits go up with wages. So as wages go up, the amount you can claim in uninsurance benefit goes up because it's supposed to be about half of your weekly earnings. So as your earnings go up, you get more. Taxes don't go up with wages. Taxes are fixed. They're fixed at about the first $15,000 of what people earn. Businesses pay on that. So you can imagine in a system where benefits are always increasing automatically to keep up with wages, but taxes aren't increasing automatically, you inevitably end up in a system where taxes aren't covering benefits. So that's the technical problem.
All right. So now take us to this group. Who, now, I don't need names, but give us the...
I mean, the names are out there.
Yeah.
You know, it was not a secret group. It was a very public group. We met publicly. We talked publicly. And in fact, that was one of the big challenges of the group is that everything happened publicly. But, you know, it involved a number of people, some on the business side, you know, some on the labor side, some, you know, people like me. You know, I'm not a lobbyist. I'm a researcher. And then two legislative leaders, one from the House, one from the Senate. And, you know, we had a series of meetings over time. We had interesting discussions. We had good speakers. And at the end of the day, we just couldn't agree on a package. And I say the public nature of it was a big part of the challenge.
Why?
I don't want to, like, anticipate your questions. Like, why didn't we get to consensus of some sort? People have different preferences. They, you know, the business side folks want different things than the labor side folks. And I want different things as a researcher who, like, studies best practices in other states. And it's nice to go into a room and say, all right, what is it that you really want? What is it the thing that you say you want because you're a lobbyist and you stand for an interest group and so you have to say that in public to make your constituents really happy? What's the thing you're really going to fight for and what would you trade? Like, maybe I'll trade this thing, which is less important to me, and you'll trade that thing and we'll end up with a compromise we don't really like, but we'll agree to it. And if you can close doors, you can get around a table, you can hash out that kind of compromise. You do that kind of horse trading and say, listen, I don't love this, but I think it's better. And you're also sacrificing something. And we're going to end up in a system with like higher taxes. Let's say one version of this compromise would be businesses agree that they need to be paying a little more in taxes. And the amount that they're paying has to be adjusted so that it keeps up with wages. And the labor groups agree, you know what, maybe we make eligibility a little bit too easy right now, and we should tighten eligibility requirements and make it so that people have to have a little bit more attachment to the workforce before they're eligible.
Do you think if you had been able to have that group meet privately to do that horse trading and those trades were made, that the recommendations would have been approved by, and my understanding is that there was a majority vote to approve the recommendations, but you needed more than a majority vote?
Yes. So the answer to the first question is, I really do think that we could have come to an agreement like that had we been able to close doors and talk amongst ourselves, and we weren't. So yes to that. The other is like, yeah, we got a majority vote. It's not that we decided we wanted a higher consensus than that. There was nothing forcing us to get to 2/3 or 3/4 except our own decision that it would be best as a commission if we came to 2/3. So, you know, we also set ourselves a very high bar. And then failed to.
So couldn't you undo that now? I mean, now we have an unemployment insurance trust fund that doesn't have a mechanism in place to fix this problem. Couldn't you guys go back and change that threshold?
Well, in some ways, it doesn't matter all that much in that, like, whatever we decided was not going to have the force of law, right? We were not empowered to write legislation. We were just going to make recommendations to the legislature. And the legislature could still turn around and say, well, they got a majority. Maybe this is a good package. Let's move forward on that basis. And I will say, you know, we had two legislative leaders on this commission, that's Senator Pat Jalin and Representative Josh Cutler. They both voted for the package. So there was a package on the table. It kind of loosely involved the compromise that I laid out, plus some other things. Again, this is all public. Go check it out. They both voted for it. So there's at least some legislative momentum for it. Legislators could still go forward on this basis. But the commission could have provided some backing, some cover to push ahead with a compromise like this. And a compromise can be difficult. And we weren't able to.
What is the most important thing in those recommendations that you think needs to happen? You said at the beginning of this conversation, this is a system that needs reform.
I think that taxes need to be indexed. I mean, most important thing that needs to be fixed is this problem where benefits keep up with wages and taxes don't. But it's pretty straightforward to change the tax system so that taxes are also automatically updated every year to
all
keep
taxes,
up with
wages.
The unemployment insurance taxes. Sorry. So the unemployment insurance taxes on businesses are updated every year to keep up with wages. If you did that one change, it fixes a huge part of the problem. And it would keep the system kind of roughly in balance moving forward.
And would that then take the authority out of the hands of the legislature? Because right now there's a level of indexing that's there, but it doesn't happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, the interesting response to this, I think, is that you can never take responsibility out of the hands of the legislature, right? You can never – one of the sort of grounding principles of legislation is you can't bind future legislators. You make a decision today and you say, guess what? Future legislators, you can't change this. And then the future legislators come and they say, what do you mean I can't change it? I'm the legislature. We're the legislature now. We'll change what we want. So – you can say, no, we make it automatic and then the legislature can't intervene. But of course, they could always come in and say, you know what, let's block the automatic indexing. However, we do have lots of parts of the tax code that are updated automatically, that do have this. So it's not alien. It's not unusual. Every tax bracket gets updated like this every year. I'm writing now about the senior circuit breaker. There's a tax deduction for seniors. It gets updated every year. We could just do the same thing with unemployment insurance taxes.
All right. Evan Horowitz is executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University, also a member of the Unemployment Insurance Commission that didn't quite get there on their recommendations. Evan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Recently on the show, we talked with WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger. You might remember she was trying to shop without buying any plastic, and she found it incredibly hard to do that. That was part of WBUR's Cooked newsletter on sustainable eating. And that conversation with Martha kind of put plastic front of mind for us here at Radio Boston. So imagine if we could modify the genes in a bunch of different plants and then string those together to make a better plastic, something that would be plasticky when we needed it to be plasticky, but then would actually biodegrade when we're done with it in a way that plastic right now doesn't. Of course, there's also this other question, which is imagine the ethical implications of being able to do that. What else could you do with that technology? Well, we can ask because Chris Prather is the Arthur D. Little Professor of Chemical Engineering at MIT. She's imagining all of that in her lab, and she's here in Studio 2. So, Chris, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So I'm going to start with the big picture. What is the ultimate end game here, Chris? What are you trying to do?
Great. So let me start. First of all, I have to say, I love the word plasticky. I'm gonna keep
it's
that.
It's yours.
And I'm going to use it. I'll give you attribution for it, but I'm going to use that. The ultimate goal here is twofold. One is to actually recognize where you started with, which is that plastics have done such a large impact on our lives. It is very difficult to imagine our life without them, even if you understand what the potential ramifications could be of having them persist in the environment. They are useful. They are beneficial, and we can't easily get rid of them. And so if we start from that premise and say there are things that we really need that have this function of a plastic, then the question becomes, how do you mitigate the damage that's done if they persist in the environment indefinitely, if they accumulate in the oceans and things like that? So our end goal here is to try to still give us those materials, those plastics that are plasticky when we need them, but to pre-design them, if you will, such that at their end of life, they are much more environmentally responsible and they can go back to where they came from, which is back into the soil, back as carbon that can be used to then fuel the growth of new plants that can give us new materials.
And you do that through what's called synthetic biology. Interestingly, we had a synthetic biologist on the show yesterday, but still, tell us what that means, synthetic biology.
So synthetic biology, my joke for that is always, you can ask five different people what it really means. You'll get at least six different definitions. But the definition that I like is that this is really about engineering biology, using biology, meaning living things, as a platform or a substrate for new design that give us new functions. Okay, so what does that mean in the context of what we're doing? Well, we start by asking, where does the stuff come from that gives us these plastics? Plastics are what are known as polymers. Those polymers are composed of monomers, and overwhelmingly, those monomers come from petroleum. They come from oil and other oil-derived precursors. So our objective is to be able to produce the same functionally equivalent materials, but in a way that allows us to take advantage of biology, which is by definition and by nature renewable and sustainable.
So living things and using living things to create this new plastic?
Exactly, using living things. And the living things that we use are microbes, microorganisms, especially bacteria. But there are people who do this with yeast. You can think about the yeast that's used to bake bread or yeast that's used to brew adult beverages. Those organisms can all be engineered using synthetic biology, where we can change the DNA that's contained within them to allow them to produce new molecules. We can then isolate or purify those molecules and then use them to make these materials that we need as plastics.
So this feels like a double-edged sword because it also sort of sounds like a Frankenplant, right? And when you do that, we know that genetic engineering has controversy behind it.
It does.
So what are you wary of and what are the ethical concerns that come up for you in your work?
Sure. So I will say for us, I'll put it this way. One of the big concerns always about anything that's genetically engineered is about its release into the environment. Okay. And especially given that our objective is to try to mitigate damage to the environment as much as possible, one of the things that we're always cautious about is, what is it about these organisms that we're creating? Are we making things that are more or less likely to escape? I'll put that into air quotes, even though your listeners can't see the air quotes. And what's their potential to do harm or to do damage? So the case is that most of what we engineer, these cells are not very happy. We engineer them in a way that they really like to live in the stainless steel vessels that we put them in. They don't like to escape and live in the natural environment because they're so changed from what they were before that they can't really survive. But we also have to make sure that on the engineering side, the process engineering side now, that we have appropriate safeguards in place so that we don't have accidental release and accidental exposure. So we have a little bit of the advantage in that what we are engineering is going to be contained. What we're producing from that is separated from the genetically engineered organisms. And so we are able to have a little bit of a shield there. But you mentioned earlier that people are also looking at plants that you would grow in the ground and having those be engineered to produce plastics and materials as well. And the same sorts of concerns come into place, which is, how do you actually have containment? How do you make sure that you're not going to disrupt the natural ecosystem by what you're adding in that's been engineered?
But you always do, right? There's a piece of me. I'm going to dumb down this conversation for my end for a second. I'm thinking Jeff Goldblum, first Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. Oh, the dinosaurs can't reproduce on their own. And he says, nature finds a way, right? When you make changes like this,
there's always going to be some fundamental change that gets out there, isn't there?
There will always be fundamental changes. But what we have to remember is that we've done this throughout the recorded civilized history or domesticated agriculture. Okay, so what we've done, if you look specifically at plants, what we've traditionally have done is to take different breeds and to crossbreed them in a way that if you look at, there are these wonderful pictures that you can find that looks at what did a corn stalk or a maize look like back in the early 1600s, and what does corn look like now? And you would, if you came from a different planet, you wouldn't actually recognize those as the same species, because they have been engineered in a way that we actually are now purposefully breeding different species together in order to give us something new.
So give us a couple of examples where this kind of synthetic biology to solve a problem has already been done safely and successfully.
Oh, sure. So one example I love actually comes from the lab where I was a graduate student. This was at the University of California at Berkeley with Jay Kiesling. And the problem that they were addressing was that malaria is a disease that's endemic, especially in Africa. And there was well known to be a plant natural product, meaning if, almost think about it as brewing a tea, but something you could extract from plant leaves that actually was very effective in curing malaria. However, availability of the drug was very limited, both because it's difficult to cultivate very large amounts of the plant, and it was also very much subject to seasonal variation. So if there's a drought, there's no plant. If there's a flood, there's no plant. So what the Kiesling lab did was to say, we know that the plant that makes this compound has DNA in it that will give us that ability to produce it in something else. So they engineered a strain of yeast, similar again to what you may have from having a fermentation of wine, to produce this chemical compound. It was much more scalable. It was much more reliable. And that then allowed them to say, and they worked with pharmaceutical manufacturers to do this, to say we have a consistent, reliable supply of this drug that actually is going to be used to cure a really terrible disease, which is malaria. So that's an example of the kinds of thing that the technology can do, which is to allow us to have more ready access and more reliable access to all sorts of compounds that have a real direct and beneficial impact on human life.
We're talking about using synthetic biology to make a better kind of plastic. We're speaking with Professor of Chemical Engineering at MIT, Chris Prather. So I want to bring this home now. A couple of weeks ago, we did an interview with an author who talked about the history of Kendall Square, Chris, MIT Kendall Square, and how it attracts great minds and builds new industries. And we know synthetic biology is an industry that's coming up in that area. So you go from UC Berkeley, you come to MIT. What's possible in your research here because of the ecosystem you find here?
Oh, this is such a wonderful question. It is. This area is so vibrant and so alive with people who really want to make a difference, people who want to use their talents, their intellect, their resources, their collaborative spirit to identify problems, real problems that we're facing in the world, and to actually figure out how do we try to solve those problems. I think what's really wonderful about the Kendall Square atmosphere is this opportunity to have wonderful connections between those of us and academic research labs and those who are actually in the commercial space or the industrial space.
And you've spent time in that space.
Oh, I have, yes. I actually worked in industry for 4 years before I came back to MIT as a faculty member. And there are certainly different approaches that we have to solving problems. But what's undeniable is the fact that we in academic labs need to be able to translate what we do into the commercial space if it's going to have that impact. If I have this wonderful discovery and all it ever does is make the people in my lab happy because we've found something new, that's not actually bringing benefit to society. And we actually need help to do that. We need to be able to rely upon the resources, both intellectual resources and the financial resources, to be honest, of a much broader ecosystem to help us to do that. And I have to say, I say to people all the time, just sitting, not so much since COVID, I have to say, but I used to love sitting in a restaurant in Kendall Square and having lunch and being a little bit early and waiting for my lunch partner to join me, because just not eavesdropping per se, but hearing the conversations that are happening around you are just so intellectually enriching and stimulating that it really does emphasize what a unique ecosystem we live in.
So how's the research going?
Oh, it's slow, but it's exciting. Research. I always tell my students it's called research because you search and then you search again.
You search again.
But we're moving forward. We're making progress. We're doing this. You mentioned this ecosystem. We're doing this with collaborators who are experts in actually building materials, where we focus on the synthetic biology part. And we're making progress. And every sort of aha or eureka moment that comes from a student or postdoc working in the lab really reemphasizes for us the significance of what we're doing and the impact that it can have on the world. And that's really wonderfully exciting.
And the dream for when I'm, you know, drinking water out of a plastic bottle that was genetically engineered from corn.
Are you asking me to put a timeline on
that? Yeah, I am.
You know, I always say if I could see the future, I'd have bought a lottery ticket and I probably wouldn't be here talking to you. I'd be on a beach somewhere. We're making progress. It's coming. I would say it's on the order of years, not decades, but it really is going to take a concerted effort. There's a very large entrenched industry that also has to get behind this movement, and that's starting to happen as well. So I'm optimistic, but I'm not gonna give a shortcut and give you an exact timeline for that.
That's all right. That's fair enough. When you get further along, will you come back and tell us about it?
I'd be thrilled to do so.
Fantastic. All right. MIT researcher Chris Prather telling us about the latest development in synthetic biology right here in Massachusetts. Her lab is the Prather Research Group at MIT. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The Commonwealth has given 51 grants to arts and culture organizations in the Asian American and Pacific Islander community, or AAPI community. And it's the result of one-time legislation that the Massachusetts House Asian Caucus sponsored in April to provide $1 million in financial assistance to AAPI cultural organizations. These organizations were hit really hard by the pandemic. In-person events that made up the bulk of their earnings disappeared, and hate incidents against Asian and Asian Americans increased nationwide. The nonprofit Stop AAPI Hate reported that there were 8 times as many cases across the country in the second year that they tracked the data. They started in March of 2020, and closer to home, there were 196 anti-Asian incidents in Massachusetts in 2021. State Representative Tacky Chan of the 2nd Norfolk District is a member of the House Asian Caucus, and Lisette Lay is the executive director of Viet Aid, an organization that provides social services to the Vietnamese community of Boston. They received one of the grants. Both are with us now. Well, Tacky Chan is here in the studio. Welcome, Representative Chan.
Thank you for having me here.
And Lisette's joining us on the line. Welcome, Lisette.
Hi, welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me today.
Great to have you. So, Representative Chan, I'll start with you. You were with us. We talked in February during the Lunar New Year. We talked about the impact that COVID has had, how tough the last year or so in particular has been for the Asian American community. Tell us about how this factored into the House Asian Caucus's decision to get the program out there.
When House Asian Caucus spent quite a bit of time talking about ways we can have a major impact on our communities, especially with the COVID impact as well as the anti-Asian hate going over now 2 years, we noticed that many of the cultural events that we all attend were not happening. And we were sure there were other cultural organizations that exist out there that we weren't fully aware of. For example, there's Korean cultural events. There's a night market that's been going on for a couple of years. So we decided that one of the ways we could bring greater awareness to Asian economic issues, as well as help out organizations that people didn't really think about doing the last few ARPA money grants.
ARPA being the American Rescue Plan Act?
Yes, to American Rescue Plan Act. We decided to target a very specific demographic that needed some attention.
So before I turn to Lisette, my understanding is also that a lot of the cultural institutions targeted for these grants were specifically and particularly reliant on in-person events for their performances and revenue, that it wasn't easy for a lot of organizations to pivot to online and virtual.
Absolutely. I'll give you a Chinese example. There's a lion dance that happens a lot during the Lunar New Year festivals, Lunar New Year dinners, as well as businesses who are celebrating the start of a year seeking good fortunes, you know, obviously warding off spirits and other cultural and religious components to it. Those events never happened. And now we're into essentially over 2 years now. There's still a lot of hesitation community to bring those events back. You can't exactly do a lion dance on Zoom and have the same effect, so to speak.
So I'll turn to you now, Lisette Lay, who's executive director of Viet Aid. Not a traditional cultural organization, but your organization received one of these grants, and it is an organization deeply rooted in the Vietnamese community for the last almost 30 years. Talk about what happened for you and the people you served, especially in Dorchester during the pandemic.
Yeah, Yeah, so thank you. And thank you to Rep. Chan and the members of the Asian American Caucus for, you know, this really important visibility and, you know, call to invest in the Asian American community. So VidAid, you know, we are a multi-service organization. So we have a drop-in senior program that, you know, we had to suspend during the pandemic. You know, we, our seniors are very lively and vivacious, but not a community that we could transition to Zoom. We had a preschool where we also had to pivot to remote learning, and our preschool is bilingual and bicultural. And so our organization, while not a typical cultural organization, was one that really, you know, we embed the Vietnamese culture within all of our programming, you know, the whether or not that's from learning the language to talking about Asian American identity. And for our seniors who are mostly monolingual, providing a safe space. So the pandemic really highlighted two things for us. One, the importance of making sure that there are anchor organizations within the community to address the economic, social, emotional needs.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt you there for a second. What does an anchor organization mean? Explain that for us.
Yeah, so the way that we see it is that we are an organization that is rooted and that we're there and that, you know, community members can come to us for a number of different, you know, resources. And, you know, for instance, our food program, which I'll share a little bit more about, is not something that we had ever anticipated doing. We'd never thought about doing food distribution. We had always
until
just kind
pandemic.
Of programmatic until the pandemic. But because we are rooted in that we provided this cultural need, and we classify ourselves as an anchor organization, it became something that was necessary for us to then provide to the community at large.
And you were able to provide culturally appropriate food, et cetera, in your food program?
We had to. I mean, that was the, you know, early in the pandemic, we were approached by some citywide partners to be a food distribution site. And, you know, people did come because they were in need of food, but then we quickly realized that the food that we were giving out wasn't food that was part of our diet, right? So, for example, sandwich bread is something that I eat every day, but I don't think my dad has ever made himself a sandwich, right? And so we quickly realized that if we were going to provide food, the food that we are providing had to meet the cultural needs of the community, you know, that was procuring thousands upon thousands of pounds of rice in March of 2020. You know, and then that has transitioned to making sure that we are procuring fresh vegetables and vegetables that are naturally part of our community's diet.
So, Lisette, I'm going to turn back to Representative Chan now for a minute. Representative Chan, first, just your reactions when you hear this organization that received one of the grants that you wanted to allocate for. What do you find yourself thinking? How does it make you feel to hear an organization talk about what they're doing?
This is something a lot of organizations are transitioning throughout Massachusetts. For example, Quincy Asian Resources, Inc. also moved into a food program. Asian American Service Association in Quincy also did so, working with places like Social Elder Services, as well as the Quincy Housing Authority, the Cambodian Mutual Assistance Alliance, an old organization that has a cultural component, but also a multi-service organization like the ones in Quincy, also had a pivot to change how they do services with their populations. And the cultural programs as Lisette pointed out, is like anchors, provide a venue for cultural events and performers to be there, but also provides some income for those associations to provide their services.
So bring this home. Make this personal for us, Representative Chan. I'm sure you have had conversations with a family or an artist or an organization where they told you a story about how this was really affecting them, this pandemic, the need for this kind of financial support. Tell us a story that someone told you that really stuck with you.
I think one of the things that really stuck me is watching a virtual event. For example, Quincy migrated its Lunar New Year to virtual event. And you had a real challenge watching, for example, musicians where you were watching on cable access television, you didn't have the same feeling and emotion and the clarity musicians can provide when you hear them in person. It's not quite the same. And also, these are folks who do not have a radio studio, for example, like we're here, to give you that full audio effect. And improvising the best with their cell phones and laptops to bring a bit of culture to people's homes in a different medium. And you can feel the loss in that. It doesn't have the same effect.
So if this $1 million is well spent, what changes?
Well, I hope we're able to keep some organizations afloat a little longer as we come to this new normal as we're still living in. And secondly, we also want to encourage these organizations to go to the Mass Cultural Council that's never been there before. 63% of recipients this grant program is the first time they've been to the Mass Cultural Council, and gives the Mass Cultural Council a chance to expand the horizons as they research further into the Asian community and Pacific Islander community about how many there are out there. For example, I didn't know there was a Uyghur Association in Massachusetts. Things even I learned brand new through this program.
All right. And Lisette Lay, I'll turn back to you. What are you using the money for? I understand you're working on a garden.
Yeah. So we've used the Mass Cultural fund to kind of continue our food program. And one component of that is a youth-led community garden pilot in a five-acre park right in Dorchester called Townfield. So right off of Dorchester Avenue in Phil's Corner, which is now the Boston Little Saigon Cultural Designation. So out of the pandemic, our young people recognize the importance of having fresh vegetables, space to grow your own food, which is really limited in the triple deckers and kind of the urban makeup of Dorchester. And so with permission from the City of Boston, in partnership with the City of Boston and Urban Farming Institute, we're going to be piloting a 10-bed community garden with hopes of building that out to be many more beds. And the goal there is an intergenerational space to garden, so elders are able to come be outside, grow their own vegetables. Young people are learning from elders how to grow and maybe appreciate things like bitter melon. And then, you know, for families to gather in just a new way for us to define what a park is.
All right.
So that, yeah, we're really excited about it.
And that is Lisette Lay, who's executive director of Viet Aid. Also with us here in the studio, Tacky Chan, who's state representative of 2nd Norfolk District. We've been talking about $1 million in AAPI cultural grants. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
All right. Listen, tomorrow, coming on the show, the latest in our series, Stepping Up, our leadership conversations. We'll be talking to Jen Fagel, who works with Commonwealth Kitchen. And that's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Do join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.